the toast of struggles, armies of salvation. Wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution. Talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution, oh no.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8:59 a.m. Coming up at 9, we've got Press Watch. Your host, Teresa Mitchell, the indoubtable, the redoubtable, the inimitable, bringing on, once again, Dr. Nyman, the epidemiologist who called it.
This is KBOO Portland.
Right? Stay tuned to your community connection, KBOO.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me, won't you, for a brief peek behind the video veil of monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. And I do indeed have Dr. Henry Nyman, Ph.D., who is not an epidemiologist, actually, but a virologist. And you've probably been hearing a lot from epidemiologists, which is good. And I'm going to be bringing up that angle of the great pestilence as well. But I really am interested in the viral research centering on recombination that Dr. Nyman does. And I'm just so happy that he is able to come back for a fourth time. And pardon me, if you listen to the show a number of times, you know that I keep saying this, but he was telling you about this on KBOO in January and February when you had some time to actually react to it. And now that things are about to get, well, are currently getting much worse, I think that it would really be good to get more deep down information on the virus. So as I said, I'm really thrilled that Dr. Nyman is here. First, I have some housekeeping to do because this is your people-supported free radio station, and that means not only do we take your contributions and your membership, but you get to vote, and the voting is coming up, and that also means that the board elections are coming up, so you can vote on them. So, please, think about whether you would like to run for the KBOO board. It's a matter of going onto the KBOO.fm website, printing out a form. You can find the form by a search for board application on the little search bar. That will do it, and mail it in by the deadline, which will be set Monday. We have a board meeting Monday. We have virtual board meetings now because of the pestilence. And we'll probably set it for the last week in August, a couple of weeks to think it over anyway. And then we'll have the on-air board forum in September, as we do every year, and a virtual annual meeting in late September in which we will count the ballots. And I understand that Women's League of Voters is going to help us this time around. And KBOO has survived and thrived for 52 years by sticking to its mission of community radio, radio up for the people. And that means that this marvelous phenomenon of you, yes, you, making the effort on behalf of your beloved community is what makes us tick. So think about it, won't you? KBOO is needed more than ever in this time of pestilence and fascism. People need their voice and their reporting and their analyses and their music. We need people with business savvy and legal knowledge and with board experience. It's not a beginner board. Community radio stations generally, and certainly Pacifica people know this very well, are very contentious because the American people are contentious. And we get together in groups and sometimes it takes a while for us to work out how to work with each other. And right now things are going pretty smoothly, and I can recommend getting on the board if you know what you're doing. So think about it, huh? And if you understand that the business world is not what KBOO is about, and yet you know about the business world, that's perfect. That's you. So check it out. And by the way, if you can't do any of that, how about tagging us with a contribution? It's right up there on the top of the website, kboo.fm. That's how we do it. We get it from you. So a couple of quick items to set the stage here. Commissioner Joanne Hardesty last night said, quote, "This evening, City Council voted unanimously in support of the resolution I created in collaboration with community advocates that refers a measure to voters this November to add a new police oversight system into the city charter," end quote. And that means that after all these years of trying to get police accountability and getting police accountability systems that actually function to keep things in place and to have no teeth is now changing because, yes, we did elect Joanne, and Joanne has now put it on the ballot, and I believe that it will pass with flying colors, because when it's really put to you, people understand that there needs to be someone outside the police department, outside that iron ring of police looking out for each other, to see what's really going down. An important reform, and you might say, well, Teresa, I thought you were an abolitionist. Well, I am, and I'm going to accept this as part of the road towards abolition. Congratulations, by the way, to Don't Shoot PDX and the BLM Truth Activists on commencing the third month of abolitionist protests. Look after each other, y'all, and don't forget that you need to deal with the lung and at least the the neurological and the endocrinological aspect of being poisoned every day by this nasty cheap tear gas. It's got lead salts in it. It's got hexavalent chromium, and these things, those are metals that accumulate in your body. They have to be removed. A lot of water, I would say probably leave rotary ascorbic, but there are things that can remove these things from your body. You need to talk to your doctor about that if you've been going to these protests. Continuing with brief headlines, and thanks to my guest for your patience, I'll get right around to you. Anti-masker and Trump loyalist Herman Cain just now dropped dead of coronavirus after attending a mask-free Trump rally scoffing at the coronavirus. I think it could be argued Trump killed him. And from The Guardian, the Trump administration is to pull federal paramilitaries out of Portland starting on Thursday, that's today, on a major reversal after weeks of escalating protests and violence. Oregon's Governor Kate Brown said she agreed to the pullout in talks with Vice President Mike Pence. Brown said state and city police officers will replace Department of Homeland Security agents in guarding the federal courthouse has become the flashpoint for the protests. She's quoted saying these federal officers have acted as an occupying force, refused accountability, and brought violence and strife to our community, end quotes. The head of the U.S. Homeland Security Department and agents said agents would stay near the courthouse until they were sure the plan was working. And speaking for myself, it would appear that the president is trying to walk that back. So it's not absolutely certain what's going on, but apparently the governor made a deal, so we shall see. This is the day that this happens. Also, there is a new storm, Isaias, dumping 10 inches of rain right now on the Dominican Republic and Haiti, threatening pestilence-stricken Florida. And there is a lot of warm, very warm weather between the islands and Florida, and possibility of a big storm there. Right now, we're at, yesterday, there weren't just 1,000 deaths from COVID-19. There were 1,450. This pestilence, this monstrous plague, is marching forward. And so in that context, I am very pleased to have the volunteered services of a renowned international virus researcher, virologist Dr. Henry Nyman, PhD. Dr. Nyman, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Teresa.
Oh, wonderful.
Good talking to you again.
It's nice talking to you. I want to say, and now witness the power of this fully armed and operational People's Community radio station, because we've got the man on. Okay, and so this is the fourth time since the outbreak of the Great Pestilence. His eerily accurate description of the virus was broadcast here on Press Watch in January and February, well before the Trump administration or the public took it seriously, and now he's back with the latest research. So the first thing I want to ask you is, does this virus still have surprises for you?
Yeah, well, a couple of the surprises already happened. I don't know how well they made it into the public domain. They kind of been discussed somewhat, but they kind of describe what happened as far as the spread of the virus is concerned and why it can attack so many different cell types. And then consequences of those two properties are not well defined. So yes, I do expect more surprises on exactly how many issues the virus can cause. Just to go into a little bit of detail on these two areas,
please.
One really has to do with why the virus can attack many different cell types. And that's because it's somewhat unusual in that it has in the spike protein, it has a cleavage site. For the virus to actually get into the cell, it has to kind of cleave its envelope protein, spike protein. And to do that, it requires a protease provided by the cell type. And this SARS-CoV-2, as it's called, has a polybasic cleavage site. So the cleavage site has a couple of basic amino acids, and they're recognized by this enzyme called furin. And furin is pretty ubiquitous. So it is widespread in many different cell types. And then it also needs the ACE2 receptor to get in. And that's also fairly widespread. So that combination is very common. And as a result, the virus isn't limited to the upper respiratory tract like most cold viruses are, coronaviruses are. But it has the ability to infect many different cell types, and that's caused many different issues, including some of these clotting issues, including potential cardiac damage and kidney damage and other cell types. And then the other change has been a change in the spike protein, which seems to allow the virus to grow to higher levels and spread more efficiently. That version of the virus was first described in detail back in February or so in northern Italy, where there were a large number of serious cases, and then the virus spread throughout Europe and crossed over to the U.S., and that version was the virus that was responsible for the outbreak in New York, which then was followed by New Jersey, Massachusetts, eastern Pennsylvania, Louisiana, Detroit, and to some extent Chicago. So all the big outbreaks that were in the spring were all caused by the same, I called it the Italian version. It's also been called the G-clade because the change in the spike changes aspartic acid, which is encoded, which is abbreviated D, to a glycine, which is a G. So it's been called the G-clade. And that particular clade is essentially taking over the world. It is spread throughout the U.S. now, and that's what's causing the outbreaks in the South and in the West. And that's what's causing the outbreaks in these other states that are appear to be on the verge of exploding also.
Interesting. So so these maps then that the epidemiologists have refer to these clades, these differences, these variants that you were able to follow with your virology research. So it all knits together, and you were able to know that certain of these variants have certain characteristics, and they get spread along those. You know, speaking to the audience, you've probably seen those maps in which different colored lines go out in different parts of the United States and around the world. So these are different variants of the virus. And I wonder, how are you able to, I mean, when you have a sample of the virus in your lab, how are you able to determine which one it is? Do you have to just make it work in a in an environment in which it can function, or are you able to observe certain characteristics of it? I know that it is something, correct me if I'm wrong about this, I think it's like 20 nanometers across, which is incredibly tiny.
Right. Now, actually, anybody with an internet connection can see these viruses and identify which are which. And you don't actually need the virus, you can just read about them. And I do that. They're, the sequences are either deposited at a U.S. repository called GenBank or GeneBank. And it's at the NIH is where the computers are. But researchers can upload the sequences from around the world. And then there's an even larger database called GISAID, G-I-S-A-I-D, and that has something like 70,000 SARS-CoV-2 sequences now, and there are new sequences that show up every day.
DNA sequences, is that what that means?
Correct. The virus actually's genetic information is RNA, and they kind of get the sequence. They actually use the four letters in DNA, so it kind of looks like DNA, but the nucleic acid of the virus itself is RNA. In either event, it's the same kind of four letters, and they're all there. There's like 30,000 letters in a given sequence from a coronavirus. But there's software that, I mean, you don't have to sit there and read all 30,000 of them. You can just copy paste and hit blast, and a few seconds later they'll all be lined up, and you can program it so that only the differences show up. And the number of differences is very limited. And this particular one that I'm talking about, the G clade, has four differences out of those 30,000. And so those same four differences are present in all the ones that are the G clade. But it's even easier now because one of the contributors actually classifies it as to what clade it is. So you don't even have to look at the 30,000 letters. You can just look at the characterization. And if you go in, you click on it, it'll tell you when it was collected, who it was collected by, who deposited it. It might be a little bit of clinical information for the patient. They'll usually have age and gender. And you can see these things popping up. That's how I saw pretty early on that the New York outbreak was caused by this Italian strain, because I knew what the four changes were, and I could even set it up so that I could identify the change within a couple of seconds. So before they were actually listed as what clade they were, I would go in and see what they were. So it's something that you can do G said you have to register gene bank. You don't. Anybody can go in there. And and literally there's something like 70,000 sequences that are currently available. And they even break them down to a degree as to how much are in each one. And that's why I said this G clade is taking over the world. It's about 10 times more frequent than any of the other clades. And hold on, I'll give you the... Right now, G said there are 75,094 sequences. And so to monitor this is all very simple now, because researchers around the world are providing this information. And just to give you an idea, the G clade has now been broken down into three different groups. And one of them, GR, there's 21,000 sequences. GH, there's 14,000 sequences. G, there's 15,000 sequences. So if you add them all together, that's over 50,000 sequences. And all the other clades are like 4,000 or less. So this particular clade has literally taken over the world. It's what's causing all the problems in Brazil and South America, as well as in India, as well as in Russia. And so the four countries that have the most cases are all dominated by this particular clade. And that's, or one of these other variants of it. But that's really what's causing all the problems, and the general public doesn't realize that one particular clade has literally taken over the world, and that's creating more problems. And that's why the cases in Europe were more severe, and that's why the cases in New York, you know, stood out so much. And it's not clear that the outcome is worse, but it is clear that the virus spreads more easily. So it typically is spreading silently. I mean, that's essentially what happened in New York. It came from Europe. At the time, the testing was limited to people with a travel history to Wuhan or China, so that the individuals who traveled to northern Italy and got infected and came back to the U.S. Essentially were not tested, and so the virus spread silently, and testing really didn't get going in New York until the beginning of March. And by the time this was identified, it was, you know, going like gangbusters, and caused the problems in the Northeast, and then these other cities were all the same subclade. And then it's gradually spread throughout the U.S. And so these new outbreaks are also being spread by this subclade. And that's why, and they're being sequenced in deposits and deposited. And that's why over 50,000 of the sequences are of the G-clade.
Well, thank you for straightening out the methodology there, and it gives me a better idea of how you're doing your work. And I think that probably your knowledge and your gestalt is probably very important in identifying these things. And, you know, it takes away the sort of theatrical, my mind's theatrical imagination of what you do. It would be, in a movie, it would be like you approaching a scanning electron microscope and the cellos would start up and you'd start hearing some kettle drums.
That would take a long time. I used to look at the viruses I used to grow a lot of virus back in my graduate school days, which was in the 70s, and I used to have enough virus so that you could see it with the naked eye. So you didn't need an electron microscope. You literally could see the virus, the band of the virus. I mean, there were a lot of particles there. You weren't looking at individual particles, but you could actually see the virus in the centrifuge tube with literally with your naked eye. You did not need a microscope.
Just the mass of it. All accumulated together.
There was a lot of virus.
The size of it keeps coming up in my mind. I mean, it's hard to imagine this thing. I read that a gold atom is a third of a nanometer in diameter. So if the COVID virus is 20 nanometers, then it's 60 gold atoms across. And I would imagine on the individual level, the rules of fluid action, for example, are quite different for these things, and must have to do with how they are able to apply their weaponry, so to speak, to the cell. You've identified some of these subclades, and you say that there's one that is taking over the world, and I want to bring this these six clusters of symptoms up peripherally and see if I can get your comment on how that might, what reflection that gives you on your research. This is actually for the for you listening. There are six clusters that have been identified by researchers. One of them is, I'll just go down the list. Cluster one is flu-like with no fever. It has headache, loss of smell, muscle pains, cough, sore throat, chest pain, and no fever. Cluster two is flu-like with fever, and it lists headache, loss of smell, cough, sore throat, hoarseness, fever, and loss of appetite. Cluster three, gastrointestinal, headache, loss of smell, loss of appetite, diarrhea, sore throat, chest pain, and no cough. And you'll notice that loss of smell is part of all of these, and I'll get back to that in a minute. Cluster four, severe level one, fatigue, headache, loss of smell, cough, fever, hoarseness, chest pain, and fatigue. And cluster five, severe level two, confusion, headache, loss of smell, loss of appetite, cough, fever, hoarseness, sore throat, chest pain, fatigue, confusion, and muscle pain. Cluster six, severe level three, abdominal and respiratory, headache, loss of smell, loss of appetite, cough, fever, hoarseness, sore throat, chest pain, fatigue, confusion, muscle pain, shortness of breath, diarrhea, and abdominal pain. And now when I list those, Dr. Nyman, what does that make you think of in terms of the predominant virus that you have been researching, the predominant clade?
All of those symptoms say polybasic plebiscite. I mean, what you're describing are different types of symptoms that have to do with where the virus goes, and where the virus goes is very broad, and that's because it has this cleavage site that is recognized by the enzyme furin, which is in a lot of different cell types. So this virus is somewhat different in that it can go to a lot of different places. And to give you an analogy, the same thing happens with influenza, with avian influenza more specifically. And even though these viruses are very different in what their size is and what their life cycle is, all the viruses have a few things in common. They're basically parasites. They only have a limited number of genes. They're very dependent upon the cell to basically replicate and make new viruses. They usually have a couple enzymes, and they have their nucleic acid. And to take advantage of all of the cell's machinery, they have to infect the cell, and they have to get in. And for the virus to get into the cell, it basically needs that cell to have the receptor that it targets. In the case of the SARS coronavirus, it's the ACE2 receptor, and they need an enzyme to cleave it. And it turns out that because it's got this polybasic cleavage site, meaning it's got three basic amino acids at the cleavage site instead of one, it can be cleaved by multiple enzymes, including this one that's very widespread, which is called furin, F-U-R-I-N. And as a result, the virus can go to a bunch of different cell types. The same thing happens with avian influenza. I don't know how familiar your listeners are with high path and low path, but just to make it real brief, avian influenza, as its name implies, it infects birds, it infects poultry is one of its targets. And there's what's called low path and high path. And the low path is kind of like flu in humans. The host basically feels a little bit tired and lethargic. The chickens kind of get their feathers ruffled. There may be a drop in the egg production, but they kind of get over the illness and they kind of return to normal.
Is that short for low pathogenicity?
I'm sorry?
Is that phrase
low pathogenicity, right? So they're affected by low path. It's kind of like getting infected with the flu. You kind of don't feel very well, but in several days or a week or two, you get over it and you recover. And that's what low path does in chickens, for instance. But sometimes they will actually with two of the different types of H. There's like 16 different serotypes for the H, which is the hemagglutinin, which is analogous to the spike protein in the coronavirus and influenza. It uses a hemagglutinin to get into the cell. And for the types H5 or H7, they have been known to actually recombine. It's actually not homologous, it's non-homologous. But basically what they do is they acquire a little part of another gene and they create this polybasic cleavocyte. And when that happens in the chickens, then the virus can go to multiple different organs and that ends up being lethal in those chickens, and that they generally die within a couple of days. And that's the reason these are all reportable to kind of control this virus. So it doesn't matter if it starts out as high path or low path. If it's H5 or H7, it has to be reported, because they can kind of change during the infection from low path to high path. So this virus that's causing the problems, this pandemic, is different from the SARS virus, which is one of its close relatives. The SARS virus did not have a polybasic cleavocyte, so it was limited as to what cell types it could infect, and most of the deaths that were associated with SARS were A, older, but B, they developed pneumonia. So the SARS virus pretty much stayed in the respiratory tract. It went to the lower respiratory tract and into the lungs and caused pneumonia, and pneumonia is what led to the death. With the SARS-2, it's got this polybasic cleavocyte, so it can go into many different cell types and cause various types of problems. So some of the issues with loss of taste, loss of smell, would mean that it is neurotropic. It gets to the neurological tissue types, and it basically affects the ability of taste and smell through that route. There's a recent report that just came out in JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association, cardiology, which looked at some. I'm sorry.
The mouse study.
It was a study that came out of labs in Frankfurt, Germany. It just came out a couple of days ago, and they were looking at patients that didn't even necessarily go in the hospital. They looked at 100 patients, and I think about a third of them were hospitalized, two-thirds of them recovered without hospitalization. And what they found, one of the more alarming results, was that they did some blood work, and they were measuring an enzyme that's associated with the heart, and it's used to monitor whether you have a heart attack or not. And they did another enzyme that's associated with inflammation. And they looked at 171 of them. They actually tested for these two enzymes. And they found an elevated level for both of those enzymes in 100% of the patients, in 71 out of 71. And that indicated that even in patients that recover, that don't need hospitalization, there's still some damage to the heart as a result of the infection. And so it's one of those, that was one of the surprises, is at that type of frequency, you don't have to be hospitalized to show these effects. And the how permanent these problems are is unclear. And how susceptible you'd be to subsequent infections is also unclear, but it's a big red flag.
And that reminds me of an interview that was on KENS TV in San Antonio, Texas. It was an interview with a young woman stricken by COVID-19, and I'm trying to put this all together in my head with what you were saying with the polybasic cleavage and the ACE2 receptors and this nature of the virus of being able to get in chemically so effectively. But she is now free of the virus and still alive. But she talked with KENS TV, and it revealed an important and devastating aspect of COVID-19. That is, it's not just a matter of whether you get it and survive it and it's over. It may cause permanent damage by these pathways that you were describing. And so, to quote the interview script, it said, the mother of five had to isolate alone for 2 weeks away from her family. She's quoted saying, I couldn't hug them, touch them, nothing. She said that was the hardest part, end quote. And after those 2 weeks, it was time to get back to work. She got tested again, came back negative, but she noticed something was still wrong. And she's quoted saying, even having a conversation, it is hard for me to take deep breaths and to breathe normally. My body doesn't feel normal at all, end quote. And so she had some x-rays taken, and they found that she had a lot of scar tissue inside her lungs due to the COVID causing that, the pneumonia. And she has permanent shortness of breath. She's stuck with long-term effects. She says will last for the rest of her life. She says she's healthy in terms of being free of the virus, but now she can barely even breathe. So she did the interview to warn others to take this seriously. She says, if you get this virus, quote, it's going to affect you for the rest of your life. It's going to ravish your body. It's going to leave long-term effects on your body. It's something not to joke around about, end quote. And so that gets around to a discussion that I would like to have with you, Dr. Nyman, about fomites, about micro droplets, and about masks and the nature of this virus.
Okay, well, the fomites, you can pick it up that way. Its half-life is somewhat limited. Most infections are probably from other people. And the masks are somewhat of an issue just because there's a shortage of masks. And some of I don't even think it's a controversy. I mean, you should be wearing a mask. There can be some debate as to what kind of mask you should be wearing. But part of the controversy really came from a shortage that when this pandemic first began, I recall I got a telephone call from an ER doctor that was in Oregon, I think, and they had just been told that they didn't need N95 masks. They could just use a lower grade of mask, just a surgical mask was all that was necessary. And he heard that, and it just didn't sound right to him because he knows that the viruses are little, just as you had said. And that an N95 mask would be more effective in preventing the wearer from the virus than just a surgical mask. And the reason that directive came out early on is because there was a there was essentially a short supply of masks, and that short supply is part of the reason why the CDC initially said that the general public didn't need masks, because they knew that if they went and said everybody should have a mask, everybody, there'd be a run on N95 masks, and then it would be even harder for the first responders and healthcare workers to obtain those. And now it's still at the level for the general public, saying that, well, you can use a scarf, you can use a cloth mask, and the idea there is that the virus is predominantly in a droplet form, and the droplet form can be somewhat inhibited by a mask in general, even if the holes in the mask are bigger than the virus. And then it's more to protect others from the person wearing the mask, although I think there's some recent data that the person wearing the mask is going to be somewhat protected also. That some of the numbers that have been bandied about is that the cloth mask will prevent about 70% of the virus from getting through, whereas N95 would be, it's called N95 because it does about 95%. And some of the illness is somewhat dependent upon viral load and how much virus you have. And so if you've got something that can stop a significant percentage of the virus, it may not be enough to prevent you from being affected, but it may be enough to prevent you from developing a serious or fatal version of the virus.
It gives you a chance to identify it and have your defenses address it, as opposed to being overwhelmed by it.
Correct. So that's, you know, some of the issues with respect to the mask. There's not really a downside for the mask. It would be better if you do have, you know, like an N95 mask as far as protecting you from getting the virus, but the other masks will prevent others from, at least reduce the infectivity. And lately, now they're talking about potentially wearing goggles, because the virus can enter through the eyes. And
that's interesting.
And the mask plus the goggles would give more protection than just the mask.
See those shields that go over the forehead, do you think they do any good?
Well, it's kind of a splatter type thing. So yeah, I mean that these types of barriers, you know, are going to prevent the virus. I mean, the virus can kind of float around the sides and underneath type thing, but, you know, it's generally done in association with a mask. So in the hospitals, it's more for splashing type things, and it's just an extra layer of protection. So
I guess it goes without saying that, of course, we've got to wash our hands a lot. So if you're like me, my hands are on my face before I can even think about it. I've tried to do otherwise. The only thing that actually changes that is when I put a really hot pepper on my fingers, and then I notice that I've done it.
Well, the shield will keep you, and the mask to a degree also. So, you know, the barriers will limit that, because people do have a habit of touching their face without thinking about it, and it's a hard habit to break. And although Louis Gober said that he got infected because he was touching his mask, he blamed the mask for his infection, which is not a widely held explanation for how to get infected. You know, there's not a whole lot saying that you're getting infected from a mask. But that was his excuse.
Yeah. Well, this is giving me a deeper idea of what the nature is of the virus that we are dealing with. And this because there is some technical information in this and the preceding three interviews, I want to emphasize that you can find it and hear it again by going to the KBOO website and scrolling down into kboo.fm/presswatch, or the other way to do it is to find it on your favorite podcast. And I'm also thinking that I want to make a transcript of the, at least this interview, so we can go back on some of these details that you've been talking about, Dr. Nyman. Newsmax, that the world's, well, one thing that I want to make sure to ask you before we get to the top of the hour is what specifically recombination, how is recombination informing your efforts at this point?
Well, look, like I said, the virus has had a pretty easy time of it so far. So it's been able to get around pretty effectively without having a whole lot of pressure to change. So there hasn't been that much evolution. This polybasic cerebroside I mentioned probably arose from recombination. Recombination happens when there's two different viruses that are in the same cell, and when it's being, the genetic information is being copied, you know, one virus serves as a template and starts copying that, and then it kind of hops off and uses the other virus to finish it off, so that the sequence that's completed is a recombinant. It's got some of the sequence from one parent and some of the sequence from the other parent. And that could help the virus evolve, and that in the future is going to be a serious problem, because the virus can kind of pick up sequences from one virus and tack it on to another one and create this new virus. And so there hasn't been that much so far from the recombination, other than this polybasic cleavicide. It's almost certain that that's how this cleavicide arose and gave rise to this virus. But it's got the same site really in all of the sequences. That was from the original sequence. So the polybasic cleavicide is in all the different subclades. It isn't really... That hasn't changed. But as immunity develops in the general population, then you're going to start running into that. And recombination is how the virus is going to evolve and essentially evolve away from the immunity. So you'll get a resistant strain. Or once the vaccine comes into play, there's a concern that... that the virus will evolve away from the vaccine and become resistant. And so when there's that type of pressure, then you'll start seeing new versions of the virus occur at a higher frequency.
Okay, the vaccine. Well, are you up for taking some phone calls from the KBOO audience?
Sure, I could do that. Yeah,
okay, fine. So the number to call, if you want to talk directly to Dr. Nyman, internationally renowned recombinant pioneer and virus researcher, then call 503-231-8187. That's 503 area code, 231-8187. Newsmax says that the world's biggest COVID-19 vaccine study got underway Monday with the first of 30,000 planned volunteers helping to test shots created by the U.S. government, one of several candidates in the final stretch of the global vaccine race. And what it doesn't say is that this is easy, because unfortunately we have so many victims, and the virus is so widely spread in the population of the United States, thanks to Donald Trump's fierce resistance to contact tracing. But returning to the article, it says there's still no guarantees that the experimental vaccine developed by the National Institutes of Health and Moderna Incorporated will really protect. There needed proof Volunteers won't know if they're getting the real shot or a dummy version. After two doses, scientists will closely track which group experiences more infections as they go about their daily routines, especially in areas where the virus is still spreading unchecked. Dr. Anthony Fauci is quoted saying, "Unfortunately for the United States of America, we have plenty of infections right now," end quote, in order to get that answer. Moderna said the vaccination was done in Savannah, Georgia, the first site to get away to get underway, among more than several dozen trial sites scattered around the country. Several other vaccines made by China and by Britain's Oxford University earlier this month began smaller final stage tests in Brazil and other hard hit countries. There's more to that article in Newsmax, but I just wanted to start the discussion about a vaccine. I have hope for it myself, of course, even though I understand that coronavirus is kind of tricky in terms of a vaccine. I have mentioned this before, but I have kidney disease. I have, what is the name of that bacterium? It is Proteus mirabilis is still playing around, even after a surgery, unfortunately. It came back, it's still playing around in my kidneys, and so I'm not out of the woods, and I don't want to get that. I don't want to get COVID-19 while I'm already trying to fight this bacterium. So, your comments, Dr. Nyman, on prospects of the vaccine.
Okay, well, you know, I think the vaccines will be useful. The efficacy and the logistics are still a couple issues that need to be worked out. There's a couple issues on the are still open issues. One of which is some of the lead ones, including Moderna's, are almost certainly going to require two shots, and two shots is a little bit of a technical issue because generally it's I don't know exactly what it is. It's usually two to 4 weeks between shots. And so you're basically going to have one dose, and you're not going to be fully vaccinated until you get the second dose. And because of the nature of the outbreak, it's so widespread, you know, ideally you get vaccinated ahead of season so that you've already got your immunity before the season begins. In this case, you'll be getting vaccinated during the season. And so there might be some additional susceptibility kind of between where you've got one dose that it really isn't quite enough to protect. And if you get infected while your body's working on the one dose, it might not, you know, protect as well as it might normally if you've got a infection that's got to manage at the same time. But apart from that issue, there's another issue is the earlier vaccine trials are going to use the original virus. And the difference between the original virus and this, you know, G-clade that I was talking about that's basically taken over the world, it does have a change in the spike protein. And whether that will reduce the efficacy of the virus as it's taking the original virus is what is being used to immunize. There may be a little bit of a drop there. The third question is how long lasting it'll be. And you know, there have been some reports of people that have been infected a second time, and there's concern that even with the virus, it may not produce lasting immunity. And then there's some other studies indicating that the antibody levels don't last for a long time period, that they start dropping off in a matter of weeks, if not a few months. And so you might have immunity initially, and it might be long lasting. And it actually reminds me a lot of the swine flu. There are a lot of parallels in this outbreak with the swine flu pandemic in 2009. And that one, like this one, started out in the spring, and it was kind of spotty, and there were outbreaks, but you know, there was enough spread to declare a pandemic. But it wasn't like everybody was getting infected in the spring. And then it kind of, you know, faded a little bit over the summer, although it was in a lot of summer camps that there weren't reported. If you're paying close attention, you could see these reports popping up, but it was usually called a mystery virus, and they didn't really define it. But then it did kind of hit.
It nailed me. I was a bus driver, but go ahead.
Yeah, it hit much harder in the fall, and I was kind of monitoring it here in Pittsburgh. I had a couple of kids that were still in school. One was in middle school, one was in high school. And I knew the virus was going to come here. You know, there'd been a small outbreak in Pittsburgh in the spring at one middle school, but you didn't really hear a whole lot. But it did start in the fall, and there was one, again, it was called a mystery disease. They never really defined it, but they described it. And you know, there was a little doubt that it was swine flu. So I'd ask the two kids, well, what's going on at school? Is anybody coughing? And they said, well, yeah, there's a lot of kids coughing, but they're not really that sick. And they're kind of, you know, they're coming to class and they're working their way through it. And you know, it takes a few days or a week or so, and they seem to get better. And it's just some crud that's going around. And I was pretty confident that it was swine flu, but it wasn't really causing that severe disease. And people were going to school and the virus was spreading, but they weren't sick enough to go to the doctor, and they, you know, they probably envisioned swine flu being a more debilitating type of an illness. And so they weren't getting tested, and it was just kind of floating around. And then about 6 weeks later is when it was, like in October, that things really started in earnest. And then kids were getting a fever. They were going to the nurse's office. If they had a fever, they were being sent home. Then there was high absenteeism, and the teachers were out. And I'm pretty sure that a lot of those kids actually got infected twice. They had a very mild version, and they recovered from that. And then there were high viral loads that were circulating after the virus was getting more established. And by October, they were getting, you know, more serious disease. They were getting disease serious enough at least to go to the doctors and get a test and find out they had it. And then schools were making announcements.
And there are parallels with COVID in that regard.
Right. With the COVID, it's the same thing. It kind of started at the same time. The consequences are more severe. So there's more deaths in the springtime. And but it's still a little bit on the spotty side. I mean, with pandemics, these are usually called the herald wave. So it's kind of heralding in the event, but it's not kind of full-blown pandemic. It's kind of just getting established in the new species. Frequently it does jump a species, and it's getting established, and it isn't creating as many cases or a severe case. And then in the fall, it kind of hits all at once. And it's kind of happening in the U.S., although the management has been so bad that we're still in the first wave. The rest of the world's pretty much done with the first wave and concerned about a second wave. And ours never really quite went away. And it's kind of evolving towards something akin to the second wave, but it seems unlikely that there's really going to be a break, that it kind of started, you know, at those cities I mentioned initially, and now it's going through the South. And then there's concern that in the Midwest, there's you know, it's starting to take off. And the death rate is starting to pick back up again. I mean, the numbers went down because that first set that happened in the spring has faded away. And, you know, you kind of mentioned it a little bit at the beginning that there were 1,400 deaths yesterday. You know, it had fallen well below 1,000 and it kind of crept up to 1,000. And then 2 days ago, it kind of got up to 1,200, yesterday it got up to 1,400. But if you look at the places that had the high deaths, they all set records yesterday. California had 196 deaths, Florida had 217 deaths, and Texas had 313 deaths. Those are all one-day totals, and those are records for all three of those. And then this morning, Arizona's already reported 172 deaths, and so that's another record. So those were the four states that had the largest outbreaks, or currently have the largest outbreak. And between yesterday and today, they all set one-day records. And unfortunately, there's a lot of other states that are reporting 40 to 70 deaths per day, and they'll probably be above 100 per day in a week or two.
We are at the top of the hour, and so I would like to ask you, what is your gestalt? Where do you see us heading since we're not doing complete shutdowns and we're not doing effective mask wearing or social distancing? Where do you see us in October?
I don't think October will be good. I expect the virus will get another boost as schools try to open. I don't think those will be successful. Most schools will only be open for 4 weeks or so. They'll end up going back to, you know, virtual learning. There won't be much going on in the schools, but that'll give the virus another boost. And I think by the fall, it's going to get, flu is going to come along, which is going to make it hard to make diagnosis. The number of kits for testing is still going to be limiting, so it's going to be, you know, hard to manage the outbreak, and I think it'll be somewhat akin to what happened with swine flu. It'll be much worse.
Well, with that music, we're out of time. And Dr. Nyman, I thank
KBOO
you so
Community
much.
Radio is a proud.
Goes out to you and all the ships at sea.
Okay, well, stay safe. Talk to you soon.